This is Audible.
Tantor Audio presents The Best in the World. At What I Have No Idea. By Chris Jericho. With Peter Thomas Fornatel. Narrated by Roger Wayne. Forward. Hi there. My name is Zach Wild. I'm in a rock band called Black Label Society, where I play guitar, piano, and sing in a style that many say is a cross between Hell and Reddy and the Velvet Fog himself, Mr. Mel Torme. I'm married to the girl I've had a crush on since sixth grade, who I lovingly refer to as my sexual piñata. I've been blessed with four awesome kids, and yes, like you, I too am a Jericho-aholic. And now that you've bought this book, you will instantly be Fonzarelli cool in your school, workplace, or even when receiving an hour-and-a-half prostate exam. Plus, just by reading Father Chris's awesome book, everything in your life will get better, even if your prostate doctor's hands are the size of Andre the Giant's. There are many things I thank the good Lord for every day. My Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath record collection, my Ultimate Warrior doll collection, and for allowing me to become a Jericho-aholic. Having Father Chris in my life as a brother has brought me nothing but joy, happiness, and several visits to the intensive care unit. This is because by just being a known associate of Y2J, whenever I drop off my 11-year-old son at school, I am attacked and receive mammoth-sized beatdowns from his little friends with their little fists of fury. But regardless of how many months or years I have to spend in the hospital, and the fact that I now have broken more bones than Evel Knievel, I refuse to stop being a Jericho-aholic. So, sit back and enjoy the Technicolor Dreamcoat adventures of my brother, the one and only life-enhancing bestower of all things Fonzarelli, Father Chris Jericho. Love you, my brother Adum. Zach Wild. Bonus forward. I always say that my Jericho-aholics are the best fans in the world, and I mean it. It's for that reason that I decided to put my money where my mouth is, and I posted a message on my Facebook and Twitter pages to announce that I was inviting all of you to write the foreword for this book. A few weeks later, after reading through literally hundreds of submissions, I chose my favorite. But I enjoyed looking at all of them, and I thank you if you took the time to write something for me. So, if you submitted a piece and see me on the street, come and tell me so I can shake your hand. I mentioned in my original post that I wouldn't announce the winner until this book was published. So, here's your winner. CJ. Who is the real Chris Jericho? WWE superstar? Rock star? New York Times best-selling author, inventor, dancer, TV host, podcaster? The answer is all of the above, but there's so much more. If there is one thing that Chris has proven throughout his life, is that you can be anything you want to be. I've read Chris's other books, and he really is a great storyteller who remembers every detail, every feeling, every emotion. The awkward moments and total disasters he's experienced will have you roaring with laughter, because he manages to turn even the most bizarre situations into funny moments. This is one of Chris's most endearing qualities. His hunger for living every moment to the fullest, never having a dull minute and creating positivity wherever he goes. So when I heard that he was looking for someone to write his foreword, I knew that I had to sit down and write. It would truly be an honor to be a part of his legacy. Fellow Jerichoholics will stand proud with me when I say that Chris is a truly inspirational person. He has a certain charisma that so few carry, and the hairs on the back of my neck literally stand up when I hear the first few seconds of Break the Walls Down and know he's about to enter the WWE arena. His amazing work with Fozzy has shown me his passion for music and entertainment. Influenced by Iron Maiden, the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones, Fozzy's music is pure heart-pumping adrenaline, and Chris always pours his heart into his thought-provoking lyrics. My personal favorite is Broken Soul. His show business resume continues to grow, and I have gleamed with delight at his awe-inspiring performances on Dancing with the Stars, belly laughed at his hilarious web series, But I'm Chris Jericho, and listened in awe to his riveting Talk is Jericho podcast. Now, some might say that he's a crazy wild man, but for me, he is genuinely one of the nicest guys I've met. He doesn't judge, he has time for anyone, and he has great hair and tattoos. I met him after a Fozzy concert in 2008, and emailed his manager to ask if he could help me grant a wish for a sick child in Manchester, whose dream was to meet John Cena. Before I knew it, Y2J arranged it with the WWE, and the little boy's dream came true. Chris has a heart under that tough exterior. He is a kind, warm, and generous person, a good friend, and family man. Following the antics of A Lion's Tale and Undisputed, I can't wait to read the next wild ride that is the life of Chris Jericho. I'm sure it's going to be another unforgettable adventure. But I just have one question. When does he sleep? Claire Curran, Jerichoholic, Manchester, UK. Introduction. Hiding in the bowels of the arena. I couldn't believe I'd gotten away with it. I felt like I'd just pulled off the crime of the century as I hid in the back lounge of the tour bus in the parking garage of the U.S. Airways Center in Phoenix. I felt that way because there were 18,000 hardcore wrestling fans in the arena above me, watching the 2013 Royal Rumble, and not a single one of them knew I was there. It blew my mind that in this age of social media, when everybody and their blog had Twitter accounts and Facebook pages, my secret hadn't been exposed. I'd resigned with World Wrestling Entertainment over a month earlier, and had looked online every day since, expecting to see my cover blown and my surprise return to the Royal Rumble spoiled. Thankfully, it hadn't been. And I was ready to go out there and try to tear the damn house down like I always did. It was the first time I'd entered the WWE with no warning, no sign, no series of cryptic vignettes to signal my appearance, and I felt the crowd was going to blow a gasket when they saw me. I'd only been out of the company for a few months, but my passion for the WWE burned brighter than ever because over the last few years, I felt I was on a career high. I'd left the company in 2005 a bitter man, and it had been a long and winding road that had led to my return in 2007. But in the 5+ years since, I felt I'd done the best work of my career, and wanted to keep the Y2J ball rolling. I'd learned so much as a character and as a wrestler in the past half decade that I'd become a completely different performer. My work had gone to a different level, and I'd helped create and deliver the two best angles of my career as a result. As I took cover in the back of the production bus waiting for the cue to head to the ring, I closed my eyes and began reflecting back on the past 5 years. I thought back to November 2007, when I was standing in the gorilla position ready to hit the stage in Fort Lauderdale as my countdown clock ticked down from 10. Chapter 1. What happened? 9, 8, 7. It had been 27 months since I'd stood in the darkened area of the gorilla position, and it was a kind of homecoming. Despite all the places I'd been and all the projects I'd done since I'd left the WWE, there was nothing quite like hearing the roar of the crowd when my countdown hit zero. And I fully expected tonight's roar to be one of the biggest of my career. 7, 6, 5. With the Save Us vignettes, the wrestling world was abuzz with the anticipation of who would be revealing himself on Raw that night in Fort Lauderdale. After the incredible response I received for my surprise WWE debut back in 1999, I was ready for another monstrous reaction that would make this feel like the first time. And I ain't talking about Lou Gramm. 4, 3, two, one. Randy Orton paced in the ring intensely like an apex predator as the clock ticked away to the moment where I would make my entrance and once again accept my crown as the hottest star in the WWE. Zero. The moment had arrived. The iconic battle cry of "Break the Walls Down" echoed throughout the arena as I walked out through the curtain and embraced my people, the precious and adoring public who were about to give me the response of a lifetime. Except they didn't. Something had happened in the split second it took for me to walk from behind the curtain onto the stage, as if a group of aliens had beamed my raucous crowd up to their flying saucer and replaced them with an arena full of dazed drones. When I started into my promo, they didn't react to my catchphrases like they once had, and the response to the insults I was throwing at Orton seemed forced and hesitant at best. Now, it's not like the crowd didn't react at all, but it certainly wasn't what I'd expected, and was a fraction of the explosion I'd received 8 years earlier during my 99 WWE debut. What happened? The next day, after some serious reflection, I came up with the patented Chris Jericho list of excuses as to why the crowd had gone from hotter than hell to lukewarm like leche in the span of 8 years. 1. My 1999 debut was in Chicago, which has the reputation of being the best crowd in the United States. The previous night's Raw had been in Fort Lauderdale, and even though that city has some great fans, they didn't have the same reputation as the rowdies in the Windy City. So it's obvious my reaction wouldn't be as loud. Right? 2. I had been off WWE TV for 27 months. And in that time, John Cena had become the face of the company. He'd brought a legion of new fans into the fold, kids who probably hadn't heard of Y2J before. Right? 3. For the fans who did remember Chris Jericho, I had appeared on WWE TV for the first time ever with short hair. I'd sported a few awkward hairstyles before I left the WWE in 2005. Why didn't anybody tell me the too-long-to-be-short, too-short-to-be-long hairdo was a hair don't? But my weeds were still at least longish back then. Now my hair was cut over the ears and closely cropped to the back of my neck, with a peacock-like spike at the front. I'm not sure how I settled on that style, but it has inspired many imitators. I might even venture a guess that the Jericho has become more popular than the Rachel in several Eastern Bloc countries. But as suave and debonair as my new haircut was, it created a disconnect for some of my fans, who were used to me having a certain look. The Y2J character was associated with long, flowing hair, and my new look was akin to seeing the Ultimate Warrior with a crew cut. Now, I could totally relate to this, as I was totally turned off by Metallica when they all cut their hair, especially James Hetfield, in 1996, or when Bruce Dickinson returned to Iron Maiden with a businessman's coif in 2000. They were still the same great singers, making the same great music, Mama said, and the Nomad notwithstanding, but it took me a while to get used to it, even though in the big picture it made no difference. Right? 4. My Save Us vignettes had gone on for about 4 weeks too long. The anticipation had been huge up to a point, but after week 6 there was a collective sense of, let's just get this on and get it over with already. In a way, the 2007 return of Y2J had been overhyped. A month before I came back, at a PPV in Chicago, a mystery opponent was going to fill in for an injured Cena. There was a big Y2J chant from the crowd, and Vince told them on live TV that it wasn't going to happen. After that, the anticipation deflated as we had kept the fans waiting just a little too long. So when I walked out on stage in Lauderdale, the vibe was almost like, okay, we knew it was going to be him, so he's back. What else you got? Makes perfect sense. Right? Now, 6 years later in hindsight, I know the real reason why my return wasn't the grand slam I was expecting. My act was stale. The Y2J character who had gotten over in the Attitude Era was known for mispronouncing names, frat boy insults, and gimmick psych gags, which worked every time. But in the words of S.E. Hinton, that was then. This is now. When I walked out onto the stage in Lauderdale, dressed in tight black jeans, white wife beater, and sparkly purple tuxedo vest, Vince hated that ensemble. Spouting off jabs about Randy Orton having childbearing hips, a nose that looked like it had been flattened by a frying pan, and that he'd once appeared on the cover of Blue Ball Monthly, it didn't come off cutting edge. It came off behind the times. When I announced that my mission statement for returning to the WWE was to win Randy's world title, it sounded forced. I didn't even buy it, and I was the one trying to sell it. In all fairness, it's not like my second coming bombed like the situation on a Donald Trump roast, but it wasn't what I was expecting. Even though the initial reappearance hadn't gone the way I wanted it to, I planned to make up the lost ground the next week on Raw. No matter what I was asked to do, I was going to make it great. I wanted the Jerichoholics to walk away from my performance thinking, wow, I forgot how good this guy is. But when I found out I was scheduled for a match with Santino Marella, I realized that goal might not be so easily achieved. Santino had gone from independent journeyman to Russian shooter in the WWE minor leagues to Italy's favorite son when he defeated Umaga for the Intercontinental Champion in his first match on Raw in Milan. But with his bland character, the fans felt he was being shoved down their throats and soon turned on him so badly that he was in danger of getting let go. Then Santino changed his whole persona and became a slightly confused buffoon with an exaggerated Mario Brothers Italian accent, who innocently butchered the English language as well as the names of the entire WWE roster. He was one of those rare but necessary performers who got a great reaction by making people laugh with his ridiculous character. But for me to have a memorable match with anyone in 7 minutes, especially someone I'd never worked with before, was going to be a challenge. Not to mention Santino wasn't exactly known for in-ring prowess. Cena and I gave him the nickname Worst to First, due to his cringe-worthy ring performances that suddenly became comedically amazing with his gimmick change. I thought the best thing we could do together would be a face-to-face promo where I was just as confused about his name as he was about everybody else's. The idea was I'd mispronounce his handle multiple times and he would keep correcting me until I finally got it right, which would cause Santino to mispronounce his own name. Vince liked the idea, but nixed the end part where Santino would say his own name wrong, saying it wasn't believable. Believable. Nothing about Santino's character, or this entire bit for that matter, was believable. But that's Vince. I started the segment by saying, because I had just returned to the WWE, I wasn't familiar with all the new talent and wasn't sure what his name was. He answered with great pride, "My name is Santino." "Santino?" "No, Santino." "Santana?" "Santino." "Sandusky?" "Santico?" "Santoco?" "Santokyo?" "Santadista?" "Santa Maria?" "San Luis Obispo?" "Tuxedo?" "Suxedo?" I'm disappointed in myself for not getting a Susudio reference in there. "It's Santino, 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 Santino," he said, stomping his feet like a petulant pansy. I calmly replied, "Well, duh. Everyone knows your name is Santino." It was completely ridiculous and got over great specifically for that reason. Then we had our match, and it was meh. Now, those of you who have read my previous books, the madly entertaining A Lion's Tale and the brilliant sequel Undisputed, might be thinking the match was Jericho curse-worthy. Well, just hold on to your britches, bitches. It wasn't a bad match, it was just kinda there. It started, some stuff happened, and then it ended when I gave him my new finisher, the Boomstick. I mean the Codebreaker, thanks to Lance Storm. The fans cheered, but they didn't roar. I was rusty, and I knew I would get better with a little more ring time. At least I hoped so, especially since I had a shot at the world championship in only a few short weeks. My first PPV match after my return was against Orton for the world title. To build up the match, I went back into my old bag of tricks and pulled out one of my favorites, the funny picture promo. That was where I would find dumb images of my opponent, Photoshop them into comical situations, and flash them on the Tron to accentuate my points. They were designed to get cheap laughs. I ain't talking about Martin Short. And they usually did. Brian Gewirtz, my old writing partner in crime, and I came up with the idea that Orton wasn't very smart. Not true, although Randy once told me he wasn't the sharpest bulb in the shed. And therefore, I needed to relay my request for a title match in a way that even a Neanderthal could understand. I told him very slowly, "Me want title match," while a helpful picture popped up on the Tron illustrating each word. A picture of Jericho for me, a picture of the Cookie Monster for want, a picture of the WWE Championship for title, and a picture of a lit match for match. Fairly obvious, but people laughed, and I was slowly regaining some of my old magic. But I started wondering how far I could go as a babyface in this new Cena-dominated, kid-friendly climate. I had initially wanted to come back as a heel, but Stephanie McMahon was convinced that since I hadn't been around for a while, people would want to cheer for me. For a few weeks, she was right, but the bloom was fading fast off the babyface rose, and I knew I'd have to make a change quickly if I had any chance of staying relevant. For now, I was still waving the good guy flag, and in Randy Orton, I had a great heel to work with at Armageddon in Pittsburgh. He's an amazing worker, and his timing, selling, aura, and believability are all off the charts. Plus, with the RKO, he has one of the best finishers in the biz. He helped me knock the rest of the ring rust off pretty quickly that day, and we had a good match. Despite a dead Pittsburgh crowd, I was starting to feel comfortable in the ring again, and hit all of my patented moves with crispness. Crossbody to the floor, second rope drop kick to the apron, enziguri, and my brand new codebreaker. Toward the end, he threw me over the announce desk into commentator John Bradshaw Layfield, the former world champion who had decided to make an in-ring comeback. A few minutes later, when I had Randy locked in the walls of Jericho in the middle of the ring, JBL ran in and gave me his wicked clothesline from hell. Orton was disqualified, and I got the win. But more important, this was the start of the Y2J versus JBL program that was going to take us to WrestleMania. But something funny happened on the way to the Forum. Or in this case, the Mania Stadium. I'm not sure why our program didn't click. In John and me, you had two excellent talkers who knew how to build a match and had good chemistry in the ring. But for whatever reason, our feud never took off. Maybe it was because we both had just returned, or the lack of a real issue between us. But the bottom line was we only had enough steam to last through one PPV. The Royal Rumble in Madison Square Garden. It was a largely forgettable match, with the only two highlights being me getting majorly busted open, the days of blood, and missing JBL completely on a bulldog attempt. He bumped anyway, leading to a huge you-fucked-up chant from the crowd. Still the most embarrassing chant to endure as a performer. Afterward, I asked Vince what he thought, and he said, "Well, you lost the crowd on that bulldog, didn't you? That was pretty rotten." Ouch. After that, I stopped asking Vince what he thought of my matches for a while. It was deja vu all over again. When I first arrived in the WWE in 1999, I had a massive build-up and a legendary verbal duel with The Rock. But a scant few months later, I was feuding with China and losing to Gangrel on Sunday Night Heat. This time I returned with another massive build-up, a top-of-the-mountain big-money contract, and a verbal duel with the world champion. But a scant few months later, I was getting you-fucked-up chance in Madison Square Garden against a recently returned former commentator. As a wise man once said, Enough was enough, and it was time for a change. Chapter 2 Team Cock and Balls. When the WWE went to Iraq for the first tribute to the troop special in 2003, I had no interest in going. I had nothing against the soldiers or their efforts, but I didn't feel comfortable heading into a war zone. Plus, I never had to worry about turning the offer down because I was never asked to go. But during my sabbatical from the WWE, my band Fozzy was invited to Fort Benning in Georgia for a signing, and the soldiers were so thankful and happy to see us that I reevaluated my feelings. When I saw how much these men and women were sacrificing for their country, I decided I really wanted to do whatever I could to support them. So when Vince personally asked me to be a part of the next Tribute to the Troops tour a few weeks after my return, I answered yes without hesitation. After my second Raw back and my match with Santino, we went straight from the arena in Charleston, South Carolina, to a nearby army base where we boarded a giant military transport plane. There was a sense of adventure and nervousness as we filed on. After all, we were going to war. The army had outfitted the inside of the massive fuselage with rows of economy class seats, crammed tightly together to accommodate as many of us as possible. Between the boys, office personnel, and production people, there weren't enough seats for everybody, so the remaining unlucky few sat on benches bolted onto the side of the plane. The back of the massive vehicle was packed with towering pallets of camera equipment, the ring, and our personal baggage, all held together with huge sheets of saran wrap. After we were all seated, I snagged a decent seat next to Cena, we received a briefing from our army liaison, who informed us that while we would be headed to Iraq, the exact destination was being kept a secret to cut down on the chances of us being bombed by insurgents. Bombed by insurgents? Yes, kids, this was the real deal. Once we received our briefing, we embarked on our 16-hour secret journey and the tale of two flights. The first flight was a veritable rock and roll party. Everybody was milling around the cabin, vocalizing and socializing, guitar screeching and hair bleaching, telling jokes, laughing, listening to music, and having a few cocktails to get their sticks, tricks, and lipstick fix. Jeff Hardy was learning how to play acoustic guitar and was so impressed when I showed him the opening riff to Crazy Train that he proclaimed me the best guitar player on the plane. He was probably right, although I hear Funaki plays a mean eruption. As the flight progressed, everyone broke up into little groups. Some slept, some watched movies, and others hung out on top of the pallets 8 feet in the air. But no matter where you went, the plane was brutally cold and incredibly loud. We were all required to bring a sleeping bag for the tour, so I went back to the back of the plane and wedged myself between a column of pallets and the sidewall of the hull, trying to catch some sleep. I failed miserably, since even though I was fully clothed and inside a down-filled sleeping bag, it was still freezing. Not to mention, lying on the metal floor was completely uncomfortable with all of the rivets sticking into my various body parts. So I went back to the cramped row of seats and tried to fall asleep there. But it was too confining, and Cena snores, which made me 0-for-2 in my battle with the Sandman. So I climbed up on top of the pallets and found it to be the only comfortable place on the plane. Not exactly FAA approved, but a good place to crash for a few hours until it was time to gas up in Germany. We landed at Rammstein, so that's where that band got their name, air base, and everybody shuffled off the plane. While most of the crew headed to the officers' lounge to have some food and more drinks, Vince, Cena, MVP, and I went to the base hospital where the wounded U.S. soldiers were recovering. Anytime you visit a hospital, it's always a touching and gratifying experience, but it can also be mentally grueling. You never know who you're going to meet and what condition they're going to be in. And considering we were going to an army hospital treating casualties from the Iraq War, I was expecting the worst. The first soldier we visited half-smiled as we came in the room. When I asked him with grave concern how he was doing, he answered nonchalantly that he was fine. I inquired why he was in the hospital, and he said, I fell off a ladder outside of the barracks and sprained my ankle. Who are you again? We moved down the hallway to another room, this one occupied by a female soldier. After another sensitive inquiry as to why she was in the infirmary, she replied,
Because I had to have my appendix removed.
Ouch, I said. Did that happen in combat?
Huh? No, my stomach was bugging me and the doctor told me I needed the operation.
We visited another half-dozen wounded soldiers who had suffered from such war atrocities as pneumonia, strep throat, and an ingrown toenail. Turns out the Ramstein Hospital was mostly used for household injuries suffered on the base, not during the call of duty. We took off again, and for a few hours the party continued. I was having a conversation on top of the pallets with Ron Simmons and Carlito, when suddenly all of the bright lights in the plane turned off and were replaced by dim red-colored bulbs as an announcement was made throughout the cabin. Everybody take your seats and put on your seatbelts for the rest of the flight. We are now entering a war zone. Welcome to the second flight. My stomach rose into my gullet. Fun word. And I realized while we weren't in Kansas anymore, Karbala was right next door. I felt like I was in a video game, except this was real, and it was serious. Deadly serious. I was in a war zone. People die in war zones. There was no turning back now. The cabin lights were turned off to make it harder for the enemy, or the insurgents, as the army called them, to target the plane. And the fact that I was part of said target made me feel sick to my stomach. I sat in the confinement of my tiny seat prison, not able to move and too nervous to sleep, hoping for the best and waiting to land. We finally did, and I was never so happy to get off a plane in my life. But when I did, there was nothing there. Well, nothing except for a desert that I could see for miles and miles in every direction. No buildings, no trees, no roads, no power lines, nothing. I surveyed the great divide of emptiness as I boarded an old-school bus that shuttled us to our accommodations. These digs weren't barracks or tents like I was expecting, but a palace. Saddam Hussein's palace, to be exact. After the fall of Saddam, the U.S. Army had transformed a number of his exquisite palaces into de facto hotels for their guests and troops to stay. This particular one was on the banks of a toxic lake, which didn't deter Jeff Hardy from jumping in for a dip, and featured a driving range where you hit the golf balls straight into the water. To do something so American from the balcony of Saddam's former home felt like poetic justice to me. But there wasn't much time to enjoy the fruits of Saddam's evil labor, as a few hours after landing we were divided into groups and escorted onto our individual assignments. My team included CM Punk, MVP John Morrison, Eve, and Alicia Fox. We were issued heavy flak jackets and helmets, war zone, and taken to the mess hall for a quick lunch. I was expecting a big green tent, like in MASH, with a chef named Cookie, wearing a greasy wife beater and a ciggy hanging out of his mouth, doling out ladles of hash and gruel. Horse hockey. Was I ever wrong? This place was like a mall food court with more choices than Polo Park. Winnipeg represent. They had everything. Stir-fry, pasta station, roast chicken, burgers, pizza, salad bars, fresh cookies, you name it. It was like a golden corral for Golden Star colonels. It made me think how much money we were spending on this war, as the cost of food for the troops alone must have been in the millions on a weekly basis. After a fine lunch of roasted chicken and salad, it was off to the helicopters to fly to the outpost to greet the soldiers. What makes WWE tours to Iraq different from the average USO visit is that USO tours generally stayed within the bigger base areas, whereas our tours went everywhere. Vince's motto was that no outpost was too big or too small, and if there were soldiers there, we would visit them. My group flew across the desert to a tiny post in the middle of nowhere. We were greeted by a four-star general who took us around the base so the troops could give us demonstrations of their various jobs and responsibilities. Then we had an autograph signing meet and greet with whoever wanted to say hi. The best part was the legitimate joy and excitement that the troops had about us being there. Over and over again I was thanked for coming all the way to Iraq to see them, and over again I thanked them right back for being there and protecting our country. It was the least I could do to come to Iraq for 4 days, when these men and women were there, away from their families, for upwards of 18 months. I realized there was a lot of propaganda on the news in the States about the war. While I'm sure not everybody was thrilled to be there, the majority of the soldiers I met were there to do their job and weren't interested in leaving until that job was done. I didn't hear any complaints from any of them about why they were still in Iraq. Another thing I felt was a true sense of pride that the soldiers had for their jobs. Each one took the time to meticulously point out and explain every detail of what their duties were, whether it was cleaning a missile launcher, repairing a jeep motor, or disarming an Iraqi landmine. We were taken outside the wire, beyond the protected perimeters of the base, and were taught how to fire machine guns. We rode in tanks across the desert, and when I asked the driver what his favorite music to shoot missiles to was, he answered Metallica and Fozzy. Shameless pandering that I'll accept every time. We stood on top of choppers and swung from a Tarzan rope that hung from the rafters of a massive airplane hangar. We had a blast, and Punk, Morrison, MVP, and I even christened our group Team Cock and Balls, after a cartoon drawing someone had scribbled on the back of one of the bus seats of a set of male genitalia with a face and little arms. His testicles were his feet. We flew across the desert to another outpost and shot machine guns into the salt flats of Iraq as I sat in the open cabin of the chopper, with the wind blasting in my face and the captain relaying information into our headsets. I felt like I was in every Vietnam movie ever made, and all it needed was All Along the Watchtower playing in the background. It was Full Metal Jericho, and I was Private Y2 Joker. Except this was no joke. We were flying over a third-world country that had been ravaged by war, rubble surrounding the small clusters of clay huts scattered about the countryside, each one of them curiously boasting a satellite dish. Apparently, after the fall of Saddam, the people of Iraq were allowed to have them for the first time. I could see random men and women staring up at us from the ground and wondered whose side they were on. Our gunner had his finger on his trigger at all times, watching out for anything unusual. And if anybody on the ground held up anything resembling a gun or a missile launcher, his orders were to shoot them on sight. This was war. No rules, no judge, and no jury. Only executioners. At the next base, I met a huge Y2J fan who was so excited to meet me that he showed me around his barracks and invited me to be his roomie. We formed a makeshift improv comedy team called Coffee and Cream, since he is black and I am white. You are blind as a bat, and I have sight. Performing bits and spewing punchlines in front of the ever-present WWE cameras. The next day, Team Cock and Balls split up, and my new group was made up of Dean Malenko, Carlito, JBL, Ron Simmons, and Mickey James. We flew into a town called Taji, and once again were greeted by a friendly commander with a firm handshake, who told us how happy he was to have us there. He took us over to our meet-and-greet, where the majority of the guys, there were hardly ever any women this far outside the wire, were most excited to meet and greet Mickey. She was the star of the show, signing autographs and taking pictures for every soldier whether they knew who she was or not. After another lively visit, we split up into two choppers and were whisked off toward Tarmia, the farthest city outside the wire that anybody in the WWE, or any entertainer for that matter, had been to. Tarmia was a war-torn former Al-Qaeda stronghold that the U.S. Army had overtaken. We were told that even though it was under control, it was still classified as an unsecured war zone, which meant that they thought they had forced all of the terrorists out of the city, but didn't know for sure. It looked like something out of Platoon. Half-standing, bombed-out buildings with smoke drifting over the rooftops and wafting through the open windows of the burned-out husks of cars that sat unoccupied in the deserted streets. We hovered over a dusty parking lot as the surrounding trees bent back from the force of the wind created by the chopper blades. Then just as we started to descend, I heard a loud bang, and smoke began to plume up from the ground. This is it, I thought. We are being attacked. My heart raced like Jeff Gordon as we landed quickly in the lot, with smoke and dust rising all around us. We were still in one piece as we weren't being attacked. Rather, smoke bombs had been set off to camouflage our arrival and make it harder for any insurgents to target us as we landed. That was the second time in a day I'd been considered a target, and I wasn't down with that clown at all. We hopped out of the chopper, and this time there was no smiling official waiting to shake our hands and tell us how great we were. Instead, there was a fully armored soldier waving his arms, shouting, "Go! This way! This way!" Dean and I started jogging confusedly in the direction the soldier was pointing, and as we headed toward a dingy orange-colored building, I took stock of my surroundings. The smoke was dissipating and the dust was settling, which made it easier to make out the random fires burning and the dead dogs lying all around. I wasn't sure what was going on, but I was scared and felt my heart fluttering like a spastic butterfly in my chest. They hustled us down the dusty path flanked by barbed wire fencing as soldiers hid in the trees with machine guns held up to their faces, scouting the area for danger. I got the impression that if someone, anyone, off our beaten path moved too fast, they would be shot. We were all in a dead run at this point, and as I was rounding a corner, a bigger bang, and I ain't talking about Charlie Watts, went off beside me. I screamed, convinced my arm had been blown off and I'd have to carry it around with me for the rest of the tour like that guy in the opening scene in Saving Private Ryan. Thankfully, it was just another camouflaging smoke bomb, and even though we were all still in one piece, it had shaken us up pretty badly. Especially Ron Simmons, who growled, "All this for a meet and greet? I would have just mailed them a fucking autograph." We finally made it to the command post, which was essentially a converted youth center, and were quickly ushered inside. We knew we were in uncharted waters when the first thing the commander said was, "What the hell are you guys doing here? Nobody comes out this far." It really hit home just how far into the danger zone we were, when even the soldiers thought we were crazy for being there. We gathered in a communications center, which wasn't the high-tech army installation I was expecting, but a total shithole. The dilapidated walls were streaked with rusty water stains, and cobwebs festooned, awesome word, every corner. The tiny control room was equipped with the type of old-school radio equipment you would see Radar O'Reilly using. I know it's the second MASH reference of this book, but I loved that show when I was a kid. You dig? And might as well have been controlled by a crank. It was strange to me that while I could still text my wife Jessica in Florida with my smartphone, these guys seemed to be using equipment that came out when Pong was all the rage. Once again, we were briefed on our situation, this time by the base leader who explained that Tarmia had been overrun by insurgents until our troops came in and secured it sector by sector over a 6-month period with a total of 75 sectors. They had all the roads blocked in and out of the city, and the Al-Qaeda operatives were gone, or so they thought. They weren't completely sure that there still weren't a few renegades hiding within the ruins of the city, which is why they still classified it as an unsecured war zone. The soldiers strayed for 18-day periods inside the control center, and since there was no running water or showers, they brushed their teeth with bottled water and stayed dirty. All they had to eat were MREs, meals ready to eat, which were non-perishable foods that came in thin silver tubes and were available in two flavors, tuna fish or chipped beef. I'd never tried an MRE before and decided to indulge in spite of the warnings from soldiers who told me, "You're not gonna like it." They were right. The tuna fish and the chipped beef tasted exactly the same, like cow shit flavored cardboard. I gagged and forced down the swill with some lukewarm water, desperately trying to cleanse my palate. I grabbed a piece of chocolate, which tasted like sweetened cowshit-flavored cardboard, and promptly spit it out as a handful of soldiers stood around giggling. The only things they had that tasted normal were Pringles and orange Gatorade, the cornerstone of any balanced breakfast. The sleeping area was a large open room with Army-issue cots side by side, wall to wall. Each one had a personal item stashed underneath to distinguish it from the rest. A book, a picture, a frame, a guitar. I should have strummed a few chords since I was the best guitar player in the WWE. There was a small primitive gym set up on the side, like the kind I had in my high school. Westwood Collegiate represent, yo. Sand-filled plastic plates, a bench where the resting arms were too close together to get a proper pressing grip, larger weights made of poured concrete, whatever they could piece together to use for some kind of workout. In the middle of the compound was a small concourse where the guys hung out, shooting baskets, smoking, talking about home, smoking, playing cards, and smoking. They gathered around a small campfire, sitting on lopsided cushioned back seats they had ripped out of the deserted cars throughout the city. We signed autographs and took pictures, and while some of the guys didn't know who we were, all of them were very appreciative of our presence, excitedly telling us all about their home lives. When one corporal told us he was going home in a few days to get married, Simmons cracked me up by saying, "Married? Damn. You're going from one war zone to another, aren't you?" Luckily, my home life was the farthest thing from a war zone, and since the moment I landed in Iraq, I'd constantly checked my pocket to make sure I had my phone. It was my security blanket, my lifeline back to the sanity of a peaceful world and my beautiful wife and family. And the fact I could still communicate with them via text made me feel a little better about my situation. After 90 minutes of hanging out with the soldiers, we were getting ready to leave when we were told that there was a problem. One of the choppers we had flown in on had landed on a steel girder that had punctured through its floor, and since combat helicopters travel in pairs for safety, we had to wait until another one could arrive before we could go. To make matters worse, a serious dust storm was brewing, which was delaying the second chopper's arrival. In other words, we were stranded in an unsecured war zone indefinitely. And for the first time since I got to Iraq, I wasn't completely sure that I was going to leave. Left to die with only friend. Alone, I clenched my phone. Chapter 3. Unsecured War Zone. With the uncertainty of when we were going to be able to leave the base setting in, we started getting restless. Some of us sat outside trading war stories, literally, with the soldiers. Some lifted weights, and others hung out in the control center trying to chart the second chopper's progress. Lillian Garcia, who sings the best Star-Spangled Banner I've ever heard, got scolded after ignoring the warnings not to feed the scrawny mongrels that were wandering around outside the command center. It was a big no-no because the dogs carried parasites and fleas, and many of them were dangerously rabid, so feeding them caused them to hang around expecting more, which made them a safety and health risk to the soldiers. The dogs were promptly shot, and Lillian, she wasn't the only one, was devastated. I didn't kill any dogs, but I did kill some time by working out in the makeshift gym, curling tomato tins that had been filled with cement and had a metal handle embedded in the middle. I watched a couple soldiers jumping skateboards over a row of plastic gas cans, and they were pretty damn good. And again, if I was stuck in that hovel for 18 days, I would have been Jason Ellis, too. I started wondering what exactly it was that the soldiers were doing there. I mean, were there times when they came under fire, or was their presence just a preventive measure at that point? I asked a few of them that question, and one of them beckoned me over, pulling out his phone. "Check this out," he said. He showed me an image of a weird, soupy, sludgy mass, like someone had spilled a bowl of oatmeal and then drawn a face on it. It took me a few seconds to figure out that it really was a face belonging to a head that had been caved in by bullets. "Let me ask you this. Have you ever seen an actual dead person before?" I hadn't. I mean, I'd seen them in the movies and on TV, but looking at this photo of a distorted head was making me feel queasy. The soldier explained that the disfigured head belonged to an insurgent sniper who'd stationed himself on a rooftop 300 yards away from the compound. He'd picked off a number of the soldiers around the command center, some of them dying in the arms of their friends. Finally, they decided to eliminate the problem and stormed the apartment block where the sniper was holed up. They busted through the front door of the barricaded building and the terrorist dashed up the stairs to escape, with the soldiers giving chase directly behind him. The insurgent ran through a rooftop door at the top of the stairs and tackled the first soldier who followed behind him, pinning him to the ground and trying to stab him with a hunting knife. The soldier threw his arm up and luckily was able to block the knife from plunging into his chest. The two of them were locked in a battle to the death, rolling back and forth trying to gain control of the knife. Finally, the other troops wrestled the terrorist off and shot him in the head, killing him instantly. I was introduced to the soldier who had narrowly survived the attack, and the kid couldn't have been more than 19 years old. He described this brush with death and explained he was certain he was going to die, screaming for somebody to help him and expecting the knife to penetrate his chest any second. I looked into his oddly placed eyes, they were almost on the sides of his head, and realized he would be carrying the horror of that moment with him for the rest of his life. I'm sure he's still having nightmares about it to this day. Afterward, I was taken to the medical center, which was really nothing more than a few tables pushed together with some field dressing kits stacked in the corners. I noticed a chart on the walls with wins, losses, ties written in black marker at the top. Under each column were four lines with a fifth crossing through, like the markings a prisoner would write on his wall to count down the number of days until his release. The wins had three full sets of lines plus two, the losses had one full set plus one, and the ties had two full sets plus two. Wins stood for the soldiers on the base who had been shot over the last year and had lived. Losses stood for the soldiers who had been shot on base and had died. And ties stood for guys who had been shot on base, survived, and died elsewhere after being restationed. As I was counting the number of losses, a private approached me, saying he was a big fan and wanted to say hi. I noticed he had a small angel tattooed on his trigger finger and asked him why. He explained that when he was in high school, he and his best friend decided to join the army. They enlisted together in Seattle, trained together, shipped out together, and ended up in the same company in Iraq. 2 weeks after they arrived, the same sniper that had almost stabbed Wide Eyes shot his best friend in the head and killed him. The private got the angel tattoo as a tribute to his friend, who he felt would always be looking out for him from heaven, keeping his trigger finger true. After hearing rumors that the dust storm was going to force us to spend the night in Tarmia, we were informed that a chopper was coming for us in 10 minutes, and we had to be ready. The window of time for us to take off and beat the storm was slim, so we threw on our flak jackets and helmets in preparation. 10 minutes later, smoke bombs went off and our chopper landed in a giant cloud of dust. We scrambled aboard as the chopper's blades sliced through the air, pelting us with rough sand. With all of us on board ready to take off to safety, a soldier came running across the open field, waving his arms in a stop, stop, stop motion. Don't stop, I thought to myself. Lift off and let's get the fuck out of here before it's too late. The guy continued to make a beeline toward us, and the pilot motioned he was going to have to wait to see what he wanted. I was freaking out at this point, yelling above the whirring blades to anybody who could hear, which was nobody. Screw this guy! We have to get out of here now! He ran up to the open side of the chopper and yelled as loud as he could. Whose phone is this? Phone? You mean we weren't taking off from this hellhole because some idiot forgot his cell phone? Which one of these morons forgot his phone? Simmons? JBL? Funaki? It was mine. I'd taken it out of my pocket while working out, and this soldier found it in the nick of time. I thanked him sheepishly while nine sets of eyes bored holes in me as we lifted off the ground. My bad. The next day, the show at Camp Liberty was a huge success, as the troops packed the parking lot area and the makeshift bleachers set up around the ring. All of them were in full uniform, holding up signs proclaiming where they were from, their wives' and kids' names, and the names of their favorite wrestlers. It was the ultimate feel-good show, with all the good guys winning, highlighted by the surprise return of John Cena, who had suffered a shoulder injury a month before, and was still in a sling. He came to the ring disguised as Santa and attacked a cranky Vince McMahon for being such a Scrooge. Santa's voice was this horribly high-pitched, over-the-top campy whine similar to the one Chris Farley used in the SNL skit when the waiters asked him if he would like some fresh ground pepper on his salad. "Why, yes! I'd love some fresh ground pepper!" Farley replied, cracking up the cast and the audience. Cena's delivery was much more ridiculous and whammo. Fresh ground pepper Santa was born. To this day, any reference to that spicy Saint Nick still makes the two of us laugh. At the end of the show, the entire crew came out to the ring, save a recently attitude-adjusted Vince McScrooge, and did a massive curtain call. We threw presents to the crowd, shook hands, took pictures, and signed more autographs. I even found the other half of the world-renowned wacky duo Coffee and Cream, and got him some well-deserved screen time by giving him a huge high-five and a hug. The experience was honestly one of the best and most gratifying of my entire career. Despite my initial reservations about going, I was ecstatic that I went. So much so that I went straight to Vince after the curtain call and requested to return the following year. He obliged, and I was booked on the tour the next year and the year after that, too. So I'd like to thank you to every member of the United States Armed Forces who is listening to this book right now. If I had the pleasure of meeting you in Iraq during my tours there in 2007 to 2009, I hope I made your life a little brighter the same way you did mine. Chapter 4. Ask Him. When I first started getting a push in World Championship Wrestling in early 1998, I figured out I needed a catchphrase if I wanted to stand out from the pack. Something that would instantly identify my fans the same way Hulkamaniacs defined Hulk Hogan's. I came up with Jerichoholics. If you want to get the rundown on exactly how it was created, read the modern-day classic A Lion's Tale, now available on Kindle. And since then, I've created many other catchphrases, some of them classic, some of them crapsic. So I thought it would be fun to go through them and explain their origins, and if you don't agree, then skip to the next chapter, you sourpuss. Maybe sourpuss should be my next catchphrase. Ayatollah of Rock and Rolla. Many of my catchphrases were lifted from movies or TV shows, and this one is probably the most popular of those. I nicked this from The Humongous in the movie The Road Warrior. People still ask me to sign this below my autograph, and I always say I don't know how to spell it. I kind of do, but I'm just too lazy to write the whole thing. This one is also noteworthy for pissing off the Iron Sheik, who said he was going to break my fucking back and fuck me in the ass because I'm not a real Ayatollah. Guilty as charged, but the last time I checked, he's not a real Sheik either. Shut the hell up. This one was taken from the movie Happy Gilmore, when Adam Sandler's sweet grandma asks for a warm glass of milk and Ben Stiller's evil character tells her she's going to get a warm glass of shut the hell up instead. One of my most effective catchphrases because it's the perfect way to interrupt somebody and always gets a great reaction from the crowd. Paragon of Virtue. This one started when I turned heel in WCW and the band Sabotage had just released the record The Wake of Magellan, which featured the song Paragons of Innocence. I thought paragon was an interesting word, so I looked it up in the dictionary. Remember those? Found out it meant a model of excellence, and incorporated it into my act. I used the old reverse psychology bit, claiming to be everyone's favorite wrestler, their role model, their paragon of virtue. This, of course, prompted everybody to boo me because I was the exact opposite. Monday Night Jericho. WCW's main show was Monday Nitro, and I claimed to be its biggest star, so I changed the title accordingly. Raw is Jericho. When I came over to WWE from WCW, I brought a few of my bits with me. I wanted Monday Night Jericho to be one of them, but in August of 1999, the WWE changed the name of its flagship show from Monday Night Raw to Raw is War. Jericho is War didn't have the same ring to it and made no sense, so I tried Raw is Jericho instead, and it worked, despite being grammatically awkward. Go, Jericho, go. I only ever used this once during my debut promo with the WWE. I said something along the lines of, all of you people are going to get off your chairs, put your fat little filthy hands together, and chant, Go, Jericho, go. Even though that was over 14 years ago, it still pops up from time to time on signs in the crowd and chants from die-hard Jerichoholics during matches and autograph signings. Guess I should have put it on a t-shirt. Come on, baby. In 1995, when I was working with war in Japan, the leader of my heel group, Team No Respect, was Hiromichi Fuyuki. During a match, he would bump a guy, put his foot on his chest,